A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about Shemitah, the biblical sabbatical year. What it meant in ancient Israel. How it actually played out historically. And what it looks like today. And this is one of those prompts where the timing couldn't be better. Because right now, as we're recording this, in May 2026, we're living inside a Shemitah year. The Hebrew year 5786, which started last September and runs through this coming September. That's a Shemitah year, so we're not talking about some ancient abstraction. This is happening. Fields are lying fallow in Israel right now. Debts are being released. The whole thing is running in real time.
What gets me about Shemitah is how radical it is as an economic idea. Every 7 years, you stop. You stop planting, you stop harvesting commercially, you let the land go ownerless, and you cancel debts. In an agrarian society where your survival depends on next year's harvest, that's not a spiritual suggestion. That's a structural reset that requires either extraordinary faith or extraordinary planning, and the text basically demands both.
Where do we start with this? Because the mechanics alone are fascinating, but the story of how this law evolved, from biblical command to rabbinic workaround to modern state policy, that's where it gets really interesting.
Let's start with the biblical blueprint. Shemitah appears in three places in the Torah. Exodus 23 verses 10 through 11 gives us the agricultural command. 6 years you sow your land and gather its produce, the seventh year you let it rest and lie fallow. The poor eat from it, and what they leave, the animals eat. Same thing with your vineyard and olive grove. Then Leviticus 25 expands this into a full economic theology. The land itself gets a Sabbath, a Shabbat for the soil. And Deuteronomy 15 adds the debt release component. Every 7 years, at the end of the Shemitah year, creditors release debts owed by fellow Israelites.
That's the part that always stops me. In a society without bankruptcy courts, without Chapter 11, without any of the modern machinery of debt resolution, the solution is just. The clock runs out and you're free. No means test, no payment plan. Just a hard reset every 7 years.
You can see why this would terrify lenders. Deuteronomy 15 actually anticipates this. Verse 9 says, "Be careful not to harbor this wicked thought. The seventh year, the year for canceling debts, is near, so you withhold a loan from your needy brother." The text explicitly warns against the most rational economic response to its own rule. If you know the debt will be wiped out in year 7, you stop lending in year 5 or 6. The Torah sees that coming and calls it wicked.
Which is a fascinating admission baked into the law itself. The system creates its own friction. A divine command that comes with a warning not to game it. That tells you the authors understood exactly how humans respond to incentives.
Then there's the agricultural promise, which is even more extraordinary. Leviticus 25, verses 20 through 22. If you ask, "What will we eat in the seventh year if we don't plant or harvest?" God says, "I will send my blessing in the sixth year so that the land yields enough for 3 years. You plant in year 8, but you don't harvest that crop until year 9, so you need food from year 6 to cover years 7 and 8, and you're eating from it until the harvest of year 9. That's a massive buffer. The text is essentially saying, "I will suspend the normal rules of agricultural yield as a guarantee."
Here's the thing historians and archaeologists will tell you. We have almost no evidence that Shemitah was consistently observed before the Second Temple period. The biblical text itself suggests it was aspirational. 2 Chronicles 36 verse 21 frames the 70-year Babylonian exile as compensation for all the missed Shemitah years, the land finally getting its accumulated rest, which implies a long period of non-observance before the exile.
The exile narrative treats the land's rest as a kind of ecological debt that accumulated and eventually got forcibly collected. 70 years of exile corresponding to 70 missed sabbatical cycles. That's 490 years of non-compliance, if you do the math. Whether that's literal or theological framing, it tells you something about how the tradition understood Shemitah, not as a nice option, but as a structural requirement with real consequences.
The biblical mechanics are clear. Land rests, produce is ownerless, debts are released, and there's a divine guarantee against famine. But here's where it gets complicated. Human nature. Enter Hillel and the Prosbul.
This is one of my favorite examples of legal creativity in Jewish history. By the 1st century BCE, the debt release had become a serious economic problem, exactly the scenario Deuteronomy warned about. Lenders were refusing to extend credit as the seventh year approached. Poor people couldn't get loans. The very people the law was designed to protect were being hurt by it. So Hillel the Elder institutes something called the Prosbul, from the Greek prosbul, meaning before the council. A debtor signs a document that transfers the debt to the court. The court, not being a private individual, isn't bound by the personal debt release. After the Shemitah year, the court can collect and return the money to the original lender.
It's regulatory arbitrage. The debt technically isn't between two individuals anymore. It's between the individual and the court system. The letter of the law is preserved because the court isn't releasing anything, but the spirit of the law. The idea that debts between people should be wiped clean is functionally bypassed.
The Mishnah records this in Sheviot chapter 10, Mishnah 3. It's fascinating because the rabbis themselves seem slightly uncomfortable with it. The Mishnah says a prosbul is valid only if the debtor owns some land, even a tiny plot. The reasoning seems to be that land gives the court something to attach, but also that most debts in an agrarian society would be secured by land anyway. But some commentators suggest it was a way to limit the prosbul's use. Not everyone had land, so not everyone could use this loophole.
Which is an interesting tension. The prosbul solves the lending freeze, but it reintroduces the very inequality the debt release was meant to address. If you're a landless poor person who can't get a prosbul, your debts are still released, but you also can't get loans in the first place. If you're a landowner with a prosbul, you can keep borrowing, but your debts survive the Shemitah year. Either way, the system creates winners and losers.
This is where the spirit versus letter debate gets really sharp. Some later commentators argue Hillel was actually preserving the spirit of the law by saving the poor from being cut off from credit entirely. Others say he effectively neutered the debt release while keeping the form. The Talmud itself in Gittin 36 raises the question, how could Hillel institute something that undermines a Torah commandment? The answer given is that the Torah's debt release was only in force when the Jubilee year. The 50-year cycle was also observed. Once the Jubilee stopped being practiced, the Shemitah debt release became a rabbinic obligation rather than a Torah one, and the rabbis had the authority to modify it.
That's a very rabbinic move. Find the legal theory that lets you solve a practical problem without technically violating the text. And it worked. The prosbul kept credit flowing for 2,000 years.
After the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 CE, Shemitah undergoes another shift. The rabbis determined that the agricultural obligations of Shemitah only apply in the land of Israel, not in the diaspora. This is based on the language in Leviticus about the land resting, which is interpreted as specifically the land of Israel. So for nearly 2,000 years, while Jews in Babylon, North Africa, Europe, everywhere else kept the debt release in some form, the agricultural fallow requirement went dormant. It became a theoretical discussion rather than a lived practice.
Then 1948 happens. The State of Israel is founded, and suddenly a theoretical agricultural law becomes a practical problem for real farmers trying to feed a real country. So what do you do? You can't just tell Israeli agriculture to shut down for a year. The economy would collapse. Enter the Heter Mekira.
The sale permit. And here's what a lot of people don't realize. The Heter Mekira wasn't invented in 1948. It was first used in 1889 by Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan Spector to support the early Zionist agricultural settlements. These were fragile communities. Missing a year of farming would have destroyed them. So Spector adapted an existing halachic mechanism, selling the land to a non-Jew for the duration of the Shemitah year. If the land isn't owned by Jews, the Shemitah obligations don't apply. After the year ends, the land is sold back.
It's the prosbul logic applied to agriculture. Find a legal structure that preserves the form while enabling the practical outcome you need. The land technically belongs to a non-Jew for 12 months. Farming continues, nobody starves, and the letter of the law is satisfied.
Just like the Prosbul, it's controversial. The Heder Machaira was and remains deeply contested. When Rabbi Abraham Isaac Kook, the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of pre-state Israel, endorsed it in 1910, he faced fierce opposition from more traditionalist rabbis who saw it as a transparent fiction. Kook's argument was pragmatic. The Heter Machaira was a temporary emergency measure, not a permanent solution. He hoped that as the Jewish community grew stronger economically, they'd be able to observe Shemitah fully. That hasn't happened. Instead, the Heter Machaira has become the default for mainstream Israeli agriculture.
Today, roughly 70% of Israeli farmland operates under the Heter Machaira during a Shemitah year. It's the standard practice for the state, for most kibbutzim, for the major agricultural producers. The chief rabbinate renews the sale each cycle. It's become institutionalized.
There's another approach, and this is where the Haredi community comes in. They reject the Heter Machaira outright. Instead, they use a system called Otzar Haaretz, the storehouse of the land. Here's how it works. A rabbinical court takes possession of the fields for the Shemitah year. The court hires farmers as its agents to harvest what grows on its own. No planting, no pruning, no active cultivation. The produce is distributed to consumers at cost, covering only the expenses of harvesting and distribution. No commercial sale in the normal sense. The produce retains its Shemitah sanctity, which means it has to be treated with special care. You can't waste it, you can't export it, you can't feed it to animals that aren't yours.
It's essentially a communal trust. The land isn't sold to anyone. It's placed under a form of collective stewardship, and that creates a completely different economic relationship to the food. You're not buying tomatoes at the supermarket. You're receiving a share of what the land produced on its own, and you're paying the actual cost of getting it to you. No markup, no commodity market, no futures trading on Shemitah produce.
And there's a third category worth mentioning, Shemitah certified produce. Under the Otzar Haaretz system, produce is labeled with rabbinic certification that it was grown and handled according to Shemitah laws. Some consumers specifically seek this out. But it also creates complications. If you're exporting Israeli produce during a Shemitah year, you need to prove it wasn't grown on Jewish-owned land that violated Shemitah, or that it falls under Heter Machaira, or that it's from the 6 years' harvest. The supply chain documentation gets intense.
This is where the modern state enters the picture. In 2007, the Knesset passed the Shemitah law, which provides state compensation to farmers who observe Shemitah. We're talking about roughly 200 million shekels per cycle, around $55 million. The state pays farmers to not farm. It's an extraordinary acknowledgement that religious observance has a real economic cost, and that if you want to encourage it, you need to share that cost.
The Shemitah law also established something called the Shemitah Fund, administered by the Ministry of Agriculture. Farmers who let their land lie fallow receive compensation based on what they would have earned. The fund also supports the Otzar Haaretz system and provides grants for agricultural research related to soil rest and fallow cycles. It's a fascinating example of how a modern state integrates a 3,000-year-old religious law into its agricultural policy.
There's another dimension to the modern revival that most people miss. Some secular kibbutzim have adopted Shemitah as an ecological practice, not a religious one. They're not doing it because the Torah says so. They're doing it because modern soil science confirms that periodic fallow years rebuild soil organic matter, break pest cycles, and restore microbial diversity. The same kibbutzim that rejected religious observance for a century are now practicing something that looks remarkably like Shemitah, just with a different vocabulary.
This connects to the broader regenerative agriculture movement. Farmers like Gabe Brown in North Dakota, the Rodale Institute's work on organic no-till, they've been demonstrating for decades that letting land rest periodically, using cover crops, minimizing soil disturbance. These practices dramatically improve soil health, water retention, and carbon sequestration. Shemitah anticipated all of this. The biblical authors might not have had the vocabulary of soil microbiology, but they understood the principle. Land that never rests eventually stops producing.
There's something almost unsettling about that. A religious law that turns out to be ecologically sound in ways the original practitioners couldn't have fully articulated. It's like the dietary laws in trichinosis. The practice predates the scientific explanation by millennia.
Let's pull on another thread, because Shemitah's influence didn't stay in the Middle East. The debt release component in particular has jumped continents and centuries. The most dramatic example is the Jubilee 2000 campaign, which ran from the late 1990s through 2006. This was a global coalition of NGOs, churches, and advocacy groups that pushed for developing world debt cancellation. Their explicit framing came straight from Leviticus 25. They called it a debt jubilee. By the time the campaign wound down, they'd secured over $100 billion in debt relief for 42 countries, $100 billion.
That's one of the largest transfers of financial obligation in human history, and its rhetorical and moral framework was directly borrowed from an ancient Israelite agricultural law. The campaign didn't just use the language of Jubilee as window dressing. Their core argument was that some debts become so crushing that the only moral option is to release them entirely. That's Deuteronomy 15 in modern economic language.
The echoes keep showing up. The student loan forgiveness debates in the United States from 2022 through the present. That's a secular version of the same question. When does debt become so systemically burdensome that releasing it serves the common good? The arguments on both sides map almost perfectly onto the Shemitah debates. Proponents say crushing debt prevents people from starting families, buying homes, contributing to the economy, the exact logic of Deuteronomy's warning about the poor. Opponents say forgiveness creates moral hazard, punishes those who paid their debts, and will cause lenders to restrict credit, the exact problem the Prosbul was designed to solve.
It's almost eerie how the same tensions recur across 3,000 years and completely different economic systems. The fundamental problem doesn't change. Debt can be both a tool for economic participation and a trap that prevents it. The question is where you draw the line and whether you build in a structural reset or handle each case individually.
Shemitah's answer is structural. It doesn't ask whether each individual debtor is deserving. It doesn't mean test. The clock runs out and the debt is released. That's either profound wisdom or profound naivete, depending on your economic philosophy.
Which is kind of the point. The system isn't optimized for efficiency, it's optimized for something else. The idea that everyone gets a fresh start periodically, not because they earned it, but because the community has decided that's how time works.
There's a concept in the Shemitah laws called hefker, ownerlessness. During the Shemitah year, whatever grows on its own is ownerless. Anyone can take it. The farmer who owns the field has no more right to it than a stranger walking by. The Mishnah in Cheviot describes this in detail. You can't harvest commercially and sell in the market. You can only take what you need for your household. And if you have surplus, you leave it for others. It's a temporary suspension of property rights over food.
That's the part that feels most alien to a modern economy. We don't have categories for ownerless food. Even foraging on public land is regulated in most places. The idea that your field stops being yours for a year, not because the government seized it, but because the law says the land's produce belongs to everyone equally. That's a fundamentally different relationship to property.
It's not just produce. The Shemitah year also affects how you handle debts in a psychological sense. The tradition teaches that in year 7, you're supposed to internalize that the land isn't really yours, it's God's, and you're a tenant. The debt release makes the same point about money. It's a year-long exercise in letting go of ownership as an identity.
Which brings us to something I think our listeners might actually find useful. The concept of a personal Shemitah. Not a religious observance, but a framework. What would it look like to take a sabbatical year from productivity, not from all work, but from the relentless optimization of output? Let some projects lie fallow. Release yourself from obligations that have become debts in the psychological sense. The thing you said you'd do 3 years ago and have been carrying around ever since. Treat your attention as a field that needs rest.
The parallel is surprisingly tight. Soil that never rests becomes depleted. A person who never rests becomes depleted. The Shemitah framework says depletion isn't a personal failure. It's a structural inevitability if you don't build in fallow periods. The question isn't whether you'll burn out, it's when, unless you design your life with periodic resets.
The debt piece applies too. Not financial debt necessarily, though that's part of it for some people, but social debt, the favors you owe, the commitments you made when you were a different person, the emails you haven't answered. There's a version of personal Shemitah that says, once every 7 years, you release yourself from all of it. Not because the obligations weren't real, but because carrying them indefinitely distorts your life, the way unpayable debt distorts an economy.
The rabbis actually have a term for this in a different context, Shemitat Kesafim, the release of money debts. But the principle extends. The idea is that obligations have a natural lifespan. They're not eternal. And if they outlive their usefulness, they become toxic.
Let's talk about the open question here. Can a modern nation-state implement a debt jubilee without collapsing credit markets? Israel's Shemitah observance is a real-time case study. The Heta Mekura allows the agricultural economy to function. The Prosbul allows lending to continue. The state compensates farmers. The system works, but it works precisely because of the workarounds. If you took Shemitah literally, with no Heta Mekura and no Prosbul, Israeli agriculture would collapse. Everyone knows this. So the question becomes, is the workaround a betrayal of the law? Or is it the law functioning as intended, as an ideal that shapes behavior even when it can't be fully implemented?
I think the rabbinic tradition would say the workaround is the law functioning as intended. The Torah gives the ideal. The oral law and later rabbinic rulings adapt it to reality. That's not a bug, that's the entire system. The Torah says, release debts. Hillel says, great, but if you do that literally, nobody gets loans and the poor suffer. So here's a mechanism that preserves lending while still acknowledging the principle of release. The fact that it's a legal fiction doesn't make it a lie. It makes it a way of keeping the value alive without breaking the economy.
That's a very Jewish approach to law in general. The ideal is real, the adaptation is real, and the tension between them is productive rather than hypocritical. You don't abandon the ideal just because you can't fully implement it, and you don't destroy the community by insisting on perfect implementation.
The agricultural piece raises a different question as climate change intensifies. Mandatory fallow years might shift from religious obligation to ecological necessity. We're already seeing soil degradation in major agricultural regions, the American Midwest, the North China Plain, parts of sub-Saharan Africa. The Green Revolution's emphasis on continuous production with chemical inputs is hitting its limits. Topsoil is disappearing. Water tables are dropping. At some point, letting land rest stops being a spiritual practice and becomes a survival strategy.
Shemitah offers a model for how to do that collectively. Not individual farmers making individual decisions about fallow fields, but a society-wide agreement that every seventh year, the land rests. That requires coordination, compensation mechanisms, and cultural buy-in. Israel's Shemitah law is a working example of how a state can support that kind of collective agricultural pause.
There's also an emerging conversation about what a 21st century Shemitah would look like for non-agricultural resources. Data, for instance. What would it mean to let your data lie fallow for a year? No social media, no algorithmic profiling, no digital exhaust being harvested and monetized. It sounds utopian and probably impossible, but the underlying principle is interesting. The idea that constant extraction of value from every aspect of life is unsustainable, and that periodic pauses need to be structural, not just individual.
The attention economy comes to mind. We talk about burnout and information overload as personal problems with personal solutions. Take a digital detox, practice mindfulness, set screen time limits. Shemitah reframes that as a structural problem. If everyone is depleted, the issue isn't individual discipline. It's that the system has no built-in pause. A personal Shemitah is one thing, but the biblical model is collective. The whole society stops. Your neighbor isn't checking email either. The pressure is off because the pause is normalized.
That's probably the deepest challenge Shemitah poses to modern economics. We built systems that can't pause. Supply chains, financial markets, digital platforms, they're designed for 24/7 operation. The idea of a coordinated, society-wide cessation is almost unthinkable. But Shemitah says, if your system can't pause, your system is fragile. The inability to stop isn't a sign of strength. It's a sign that you've optimized away all your buffers.
Which brings us back to the triple harvest promise in Leviticus. The divine guarantee of abundance in year 6, you can read that as supernatural intervention, or you can read it as a statement about how systems work when you build and rest. The land that gets a sabbatical is more productive in the long run. The person who takes real breaks does better work. The economy that has periodic resets is more resilient. The triple harvest might not be a miracle. It might just be what happens when you stop extracting at maximum rate all the time.
That's a provocative reading. I'm not sure the biblical authors would have agreed. They seem to present it as a genuine supernatural guarantee, but the observable reality is that fallow cycles do increase long-term yield. The Rodale Institute's long-term trials show that after a transition period, organic systems with cover cropping and rotation match or exceed conventional yields, especially under drought conditions. The soil's water-holding capacity improves. The microbial networks recover. The land literally becomes more productive by being asked to produce less.
The triple harvest might be less about divine intervention in the laws of nature, and more about divine wisdom about how nature actually works. The promise is that if you follow the pattern will sustain you. That's not magic. That's ecology.
Let's circle back to the debt piece for a moment, because there's a specific historical detail I want to land. The Jubilee 2000 campaign didn't just cancel debt in the abstract, it produced measurable outcomes. In Uganda, debt relief freed up funds that allowed the government to double primary school enrollment. In Mozambique, it paid for childhood vaccination programs. In Tanzania, it built thousands of new classrooms. These aren't hypothetical benefits. They're concrete results of applying a Shmita-like principle to modern sovereign debt.
The campaign explicitly credited Leviticus. Bono from U2 was out there quoting the Book of Leviticus at G8 summits. That's a wild thing to picture. A rock star telling the leaders of the world's richest countries that an ancient Israelite agricultural law says they should cancel debts, and it worked. At least partially.
The counter-argument, of course, is that debt forgiveness creates moral hazard. If lenders know debts might be canceled, they charge higher interest or refuse to lend. If borrowers know debts might be canceled, they borrow recklessly. These are real concerns. The Shemitah system addresses the lending side through the prosbul and the moral exhortation in Deuteronomy. Don't harden your heart, don't shut your hand. It addresses the borrowing side less directly, though the broader wisdom literature is full of warnings about debt. Proverbs 22 verse 7, the borrower is slave to the lender.
Which is exactly why the release exists. If debt is a form of servitude, then periodic release is a form of emancipation. Not because the debt was illegitimate, but because servitude shouldn't be permanent. That's the philosophical core of Shmita, the idea that some things should have a statute of limitations, not because they were wrong, but because perpetuity is its own kind of harm.
This connects to something we haven't touched on yet, the relationship between Shmita and the Jubilee year. Every seventh Shmita cycle, every 49 years, is followed by the Jubilee, the 50th year. In the Jubilee, not only do debts get released and land rest, but ancestral lands return to their original family owners. If you sold your family's land due to poverty, you get it back in the Jubilee. It's a generational wealth reset. Shmita resets the 7-year cycle of debt and agricultural depletion. Jubilee resets the 50-year cycle of land concentration and inherited inequality.
The two together create a system where inequality can accumulate for a while, but it can't become permanent. Land can be sold, but it can't be permanently alienated from the family. Debts can be incurred, but they can't last more than 7 years. The system has guardrails against the kind of multi-generational wealth concentration that characterizes most agrarian societies, and most modern ones, for that matter.
Here's the thing. We have almost no evidence that the Jubilee was ever actually observed. It's described in Leviticus 25, but there's no historical record of a full Jubilee implementation. It may have been purely aspirational, which raises the question, does a law have value if it's never enforced?
I'd argue yes, and I think the tradition would too. The Jubilee functions as a moral horizon. It says, here's what justice looks like at the limit. Even if we can't get there, we know which direction to walk. Shmita is the achievable version. The 7-year cycle that can actually be implemented with workarounds and compromises. Jubilee is the ideal that keeps Shmita honest. Without Jubilee, Shmita becomes just a technical debt release mechanism. With Jubilee hovering in the background, Shmita is a step towards something more radical.
That's essentially the structure of the entire Jewish legal tradition. The Torah sets the ideal. The rabbis implement what's achievable. The gap between them isn't a failure. It's the space where moral reasoning happens.
Where does this leave us? In the Shemitah year of 5786, Israeli farmers are letting fields lie fallow or operating under heder mekira. Hardy communities are using otzar haaretz. The state is paying compensation. The prose bull is being signed in rabbinical courts. The whole ancient apparatus is humming along, adapted and compromised, and somehow still functioning.
Outside Israel, the ideas are percolating. The debt relief movement, the regenerative agriculture movement, the growing conversation about burnout and sustainable work, the student loan debate. Shemitah keeps showing up in secular contexts because it addresses problems that don't have secular solutions yet. How do you reset systemic inequality without revolution? How do you give land and people rest without collapsing the economy? How do you build a society where debt doesn't become permanent servitude?
Those are live questions. They're not going away, and a 3,000-year-old agricultural law has more to say about them than most people realize.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1914, a team of Russian geologists drilling on the Aleutian Island of Unalaska struck a pocket of methane-soaked permafrost at 60 meters, releasing a gas plume that ignited from a lantern and burned for 3 days straight. The expedition leader noted in his journal that if the pocket had been larger, the entire drilling camp would have been engulfed. It was, effectively, the first recorded near-miss permafrost methane fire in human history, and almost nobody knows it happened.
3 days of burning permafrost gas on an Aleutian island. Before we wrap, one more thought. What would a 21st century Shemitah look like if we designed it from scratch? Not just for land, but for the resources we actually extract now. What would it mean to declare a Shemitah year for algorithmic extraction? A year where your data isn't bought or sold, where your attention isn't auctioned, where the digital fields lie fallow. That sounds impossible. But so did canceling $100 billion in developing world debt before it happened.
As climate change pressures agricultural systems worldwide, the idea of mandatory fallow years may shift from religious observance to ecological necessity. Israel's experience, the legal mechanisms, the compensation structures, the cultural negotiation, might become a model for other countries facing soil depletion. Shemitah could end up being one of Israel's most unexpected exports.
This has been my Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It genuinely helps more people find the show. We'll be back soon with another one.
Till then, let your fields rest.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.